accession number 18263, Reel 2.
Dick Cooper, Reel 2.
Okay. Yep. Well, when I say we got straight off the boat, we stayed on the boat overnight, and I can recall in the evening, which would have been the the end of August, 31st of August, we were made to help unload the ship. And I can remember working one of the ship's derricks, which are like mast things, you know. They act like cranes. I can remember helping on that. But most of the chaps working them were Korean porter type people. And there's a funny story that goes with that, because although we didn't know at the time, we heard the whole of the period that the Norfolks were in Korea, frontline service, we never had steel helmets. And we took steel helmets on board. They'd gone on board in bulk, but apparently the story was that they'd been dropped into the harbour, and we never had steel helmets. And so when we got off the boat, we got off with our kit bags, and they gave us two blankets, which we rolled and put over your shoulder, like a bandolier, and tied at the bottom with a piece of string. And those two blankets stayed with us for 6 months, never changed. They were filthy. You know, the old joke was, if you walked away and whistled, they'd follow you. You know, you didn't have to carry them. They were rotten, wet, dirty, stunk, rotten. We had them for 6 months. No steel, and as I say, the whole time we were there, we had no tin helmets at all. Anyway, we got on this train, which was a diesel locomotive pulling these carriages. Carriages had wooden seats, and we crammed on those as best we could. And it seemed that we travelled virtually overnight. And we arrived at Wijeonbu, which is somewhere north of Seoul. We arrived at Wijeonbu late at night. And that again was a frightening experience, because we had to. There was no proper station there. They called it a halt, so we had to jump down onto the track, which is a jump from a carriage to the track. And when we got onto the track, we could see barbed wire around us. We could see hills, and we could see the flashes of gunfire in the distance, and hear the rumble of the gunfire in the distance. And that, you know, was sort of brought it home to us that we were coming into a strange and frightening place. We then got on to American drivers, Negro drivers they were, because I remember they didn't speak to us at all, they were just very quiet, driving troop carrying vehicles, TCVs they called them, these big trucks. They had seats at the side, wooden seats at the side with canvas over the top. We all piled onto those, and they drove us through the rest of the night to what came to be known as Britannia Camp, which was about, I think, 10 miles south of the engine, something like that. It was a tented area in a chestnut wood, and it had been built by the Ulster Rifles as a sort of a transit holding camp, and that's where we went. And we were told, or the story came round, that here we would be re-equipped if necessary, and we would be given acclimatisation training. But like everything else in the army, it didn't materialise, because I suppose we got to Britannia Camp would be about the 3rd of October, and about on the 5th, I think it was, somewhere around about the 5th, A Company was sent immediately up to the front line on Hill 355 to be under the control or the command of the KSLI.
Which company were you in?
A Company. So we went, within a few days, we were straight in the line. And, you know, so much for the promised acclimatisation and training. Didn't get any. And the first night in the front line, well, it took us ages to climb 355. The Sergeant Major Boxall gave me a Browning. A light machine gun, a Browning, American Browning, for me to carry up the hill. And I think it took something like 4 hours for the first man to start climbing the hill and the last man to get to the top. It was that steep, 335 metres. And when we got there, we took over the positions that had been vacated by the Northumberland Fusiliers, I think it was. They'd been there before. We took over these positions, although we're under control of the KSLI. And that was it. We stayed there for about 4 or 5 days, something like that. And the weather in October, it was freezing at night, but it was baking in the day. And of course, we were nowhere near water. And so we were making do on very little water. And after the second or third day up there, they'd organised the Korean porters to bring up water. And we were rationed to one water bottle of water per day per man. And with that one bottle, you had to do your drinking, clean your teeth, do your washing. That's all you got. And that was a hardship. I remember, I think it was the first night we were up there, the hill had been so bad to climb that our company commander at the time was a chap called Gibbons. His name was, yeah, Gibbons. And he had a damaged knee and he had to be evacuated soon after that because the climb had really done his knee in. And the first night, the platoon commander had asked for volunteers to go forward on a observation post, which is a two-man slit trench, forward of the trenches and spend the night, which is the early warning system, if you like. And he was getting no volunteers, so like a fool, I volunteered, and a friend of mine, Ted Young, he volunteered, and we went down there, you know, which is about 50 yards in front of the trenches, down the slopes of 355. And we were so scared in the night, we were trying to take turns to sleep, you know, like hour on, hour off, and we're getting a terrible tangle. We're virtually waking each other up every 5 minutes. And this is a true story. In the middle of the night, pitch dark, or nearly pitch dark, I'd forgotten all the lessons about, you know, if you look to one side to see something, you know, if you see that, you look at night, you look to one side and you see it at the periphery of your eyesight and you get it that way. And I was awake, Ted was sleeping, and I could see this shape, and it looked like a man crouching not far from the trench. And we had a brain gun and a rifle, we had both. And I woke him and I said, I whispered to him, I said, "Ted, you know, there's somebody there." And he got up and he looked, and it looked like somebody there. And we were debating in whispers whether to fire or what not to do. So in the end, I let rip a burst of the Bren. And in the morning, it was a bush. It was a bush. And I recall when we went back up, oh, and there was a further burst of fire from further up the hill. And when we went back up, the platoon commander said, "Why did you let rip a burst in the night?" And I said, "We heard movement down at the front, sir." You know, I had to make some excuse. And he said, "Oh, obviously that was the same movement they heard further around the hill, because they let a burst go. It was a bush." It scared the life out of us. But it does, the things you learn that are omitted when you're trained. We'd been taught how to look at things sideways and all that. You pick them up better at night. But one of the things they've never spoken to us about is that you learn whenever you get into a strange position in the front line, you must look around in daylight and say, "Look, there's a tree, there's a bush, there's that feature," so that at night it's familiar with you, to you. So that if you see a shape at night, you think, "Oh, that's such and such." But of course, we were never taught that sort of thing. And this is why the bush had scared the life out of us. Because we'd never sort of orientated ourselves to what our surroundings before we'd gone to sleep, or before we'd taken over the position and that. And then various things happened. So we stayed up there for, as I recall, 5 days a week, something like that. And then we moved off forward down the slopes, which were more gradual. Facing the enemy, the slope was gradual. As it was called Little Gibraltar 355, it was that wedge shape. And so it was steep to climb up from our side, but going forward towards the enemy, it was quite it was quite easy to go to. And we went forward, crossed a small valley, crossed a stream, and up onto a feature called Bunker Hill. 128, I think it was. It's called Bunker Hill. Named by the Americans, of course, because of the amount of holes and bunkers in there. One thing I do recall, going across the stream, we were so hot, as I said, you know, water was a luxury. We were so hot that some of the chaps were deliberately stumbling and falling over, fully clothed in the stream, on purpose, of course, you know. We were all splashing ourselves, you know, because it was that warm, you know. Anyway, when we got on Bunker Hill, we were a little bit more used to what we were facing. But we hadn't come across the enemy, although the enemy were in the vicinity. There'd been one or two sporadic mortar bombs dropped on us, or tried to drop on us, whilst we were on 355. But it's a difficult place to, you know, from the Chinese side being further away, to aim for, and no casualties. Got onto Bunker Hill, nothing, you know, other than the fact that we were, you know, digging in and kept awake, you know, improving the trenches, improving the defensive positions. We never had any contact with the enemy whatsoever. So after a short period of time, we were taken out of off Bunker Hill and back to a semi-reserve position, which was the Peakhang Reservoir. We called it Peacock Hills, and we were there for a little while. And whilst we were there at the Peacock Hills, we did a few more things like bits of training, that sort of thing, checking over equipment. The usual things you do in the reserve, you know, sort out all the bits and pieces that you need. We were gradually becoming more and more used to it, though. One of the things I remember, we'd always been so particular about our BD, our battle dress, you know, nicely, all nice and clean, nicely pressed, boots nicely shined and all that. Well, now this has all gone by the board. We were dusty, well, dirty, but it was dust. It was thick with dust, everything. And I was amazed how quickly the BD wore out. You could actually, after a few weeks, you were seeing the canvas, all the nap had gone off the clothing. And ammunition boots, which had seemed so big and heavy when you were a recruit, felt like slippers, and they were wearing so bad, you know. You just felt that everything was wearing out rapidly. And where did we go from there? We went back into reserve, then we went back into the line, virtually at the same place, but not actually on Bunker Hill, on the bottom of a feature, which I think it was 266, which we called Finger. It was on the foothills of this feature called Finger, I think it was. And we went back there for a while. And life then had evolved into experiencing the occasional shelling from the enemy or mortaring. They would occasionally shell us or mortar us. But frenzied activity in the patrolling area. The battalion was then really committed to patrolling, so the four rifle companies were pretty well stretched, because the areas that we used to have to cover were quite vast, and it always seemed that the British battalions were thin on the ground. We seemed to have vast areas to cover, so patrolling was the name of the game then, and just keeping your head down whenever the enemy tried to stonk you, because stonk was the word then, wasn't it? It was stonk. Yeah. So that's how we stayed for till round about the end of November. But there was lots going on around us. 355, the Americans were on it at that time, at the end of November. And I think 355 was attacked by the Chinese and taken. They pushed the Americans off, but then the Americans counterattacked and took it back again. There was lots of activity going on around us, but for some reason, we were there in the line, not getting affected, other than, you know, spasmodic shelling or mortaring, things like that. And we stayed like that until the end of November, when we were taken out of the line Went back for a short period, I think, to the Peacock Hills again. And then from there, we went to an area in the Samichon Valley, overlooking the Samichon Valley. And we took over from the Canadian Vendeuse, 22nd Regiment, the Vendeuse. We took over from them. And we experienced the Korean winter, which was something to be experienced. It's strange though, we got very used to the cold because the cold came gradually. You were living in the open, living in holes in the ground, living like moles. You never experienced it suddenly come from a warm room to the cold. It was gradual. You were used to it. I suppose something like an Eskimo gets used to the cold. And so when we were getting nights, you know, or days of well below freezing all day, nights would drop to 20 below zero, and 30 to 35 degrees of frost wasn't uncommon. You could hear the air crackling. It was that cold. It would seem to crackle around you. It was that cold. By then we'd been issued winter equipment. We'd had this gabardine with kapok lining, and those thick rubber-soled shoes with insoles, boots rather, with insoles. And the equipment was, the clothing was quite good. It worked. And the winter, though, was, again, it was a static period. The enemy didn't advance, we didn't advance, and it stood facing each other across the Samichon Valley. The intelligence reports that we get, which I thought were pretty measly, we never seemed to be put in the picture too much, which was one of the things that we complained about a lot. I don't know how much, you know, the NCOs or the officers knew, but they never seemed to put us too much into the picture. But stories we heard that there was a couple of battalions of Chinese right opposite us. So we were well outnumbered, which didn't used to please us too much. And the whole of the winter was spent patrolling. And quite often there were engagements between us and the enemy. The battalion was committed to sending out something like two patrols a night. Usually patrols consisted of anywhere between 12 and 15 men. ORs, which would be NCOs and privates, and usually under the command, a patrol of that strength would be under the command of an officer, you know, a subaltern, a second lieutenant, usually. And when you think in terms of that, each company had, a battalion would only have 12 platoons, so you could say 12 platoon officers, so it was coming around pretty quick. And virtually everybody saw action. Everybody in the rough company saw action sometime or other out in that valley. I myself was out there with Gunton, Second Lieutenant Gunton. I was carrying the radio at the time, and we'd gone out on a fairly large ambush patrol to the Samichon River, and it was thick snow. We were all dressed in that white cotton camouflage equipment, so we're totally white. You know, like white hoods, white parka, white trousers. The only thing that wasn't white were your boots and your webbing and your weapon. And we'd gone out to the Samichon River, and we'd laid down there to mount an ambush patrol, because previous patrols had told us that's where the enemy were crossing in strength. So we'd laid there till about 2 a.m, and we could hear the enemy in the distance. We hadn't seen anybody. We could hear them, but we hadn't seen them. And apparently they'd been coming around behind us, and we didn't know this. And we were lying there, and about 2 a.m, I still remember Gunton said to me, "Get on the radio." And my legs were paining me. They were so cold. I couldn't feel my feet. My legs were paining me. I thought, if I lay much longer, I'm never going to be able to walk. It was that cold, you know. And he said to me, "Get on the radio." So I called up the call sign, you know, in a whisper, you know, "Cobblestone, One Able," that sort of thing, whispering to get it through. And I passed him the handset, and he gave the call sign, and he said, "We are brass monkeys, over." And the chap at the other end was Lance Corporal Andrews. He had one of them accents. And I could hear him, because I once said, he's going, "Repeat your message, over." And he was going, "We are brass monkeys." It took ages for him to catch on. And then the major got on the blower and he said, "Come back." Because we were that cold, if we'd stayed any longer, we couldn't. And when we got up, oh, it was terrible. And so we started to make our way back across the frozen paddies, which was ice. So a few yards down the track, we turned off the track, climbed over a bund. You know, the bund is the amount of earth that goes around the paddy field. Climbed over the bund onto a paddy, which had this stunted stuff growing through it, whether it was rice or whatever, I don't know. And we were walking in a staggered, you know, open order across. And apparently these Chinese had come behind us and they were lying in the bund. And we were just walking towards them. And the first thing I knew was a concussion grenade landed in front of us and blew. And I saw nothing but stars. And you know, I couldn't have been out for more than a few seconds. I came through looking up at a clear sky, stars in the sky, and unhurt. And then all hell broke loose. I was pumping away with my Sten, and the patrol commander was at my side, and he was pumping away with his Sten, and we had a Bren gun going, rifles, and what with the enemy firing at us, the air was thick, it was like hornets, it was thick with small arms fire. Anyway, we got away from that. They stopped before we did, because I could actually see them standing up. We were all laying down by now and firing towards them. A lot of them were standing up. But anyway, they broke off the engagement and we got away. No casualties. You know, we were pretty fortunate, you know. And that sort of thing used to happen quite a lot. Bearing in mind that we did suffer casualties, but we usually it usually happened that the enemy suffered far more than we did. There was lots of instances like that. Tony Tao, my original platoon commander, he got the Military Cross for an action in the Samachon. My own platoon commander, he got a Military Cross for an action later on in the year. Ben Chapman, I think he got a Military Cross. You know, we did lose men out there, though, you know, unfortunately. Some of the engagements, you know, we did get ambushed and things like that. But I was fortunate. I got away with it. Overall, I think, if looking at some of the records that I've got, our casualties, dead, wounded, and missing, totaled 124. And although that's dreadful to think about, because each number is an individual with a life and a family to grieve and everything, we were lucky, because if you think in terms of the battalion would have been 700, possibly 800 men, that's quite a low count to have spent, you know, all that time in the front line. And we were very lucky, because when we eventually left the Samichon, it was 5.5 months we were in the line overlooking the Samichon, with only an odd break. A platoon or a section from each platoon would go out and go behind the lines and join what they call a skunk hunt, where you swept back through the empty villages behind to see if you could catch guerrillas, you know, because there was all sorts of infiltration going on. And other than breaks like that, we weren't affected at all. Like we never suffered a full-scale attack. We never were called upon to do a full-scale assault. And we were, although we were outnumbered and faced with these, what we were told, huge gatherings of enemy troops, we were never affected to that degree. Yet when we left, the day we left in March, the next day they were mortared. Our positions were mortared. And a couple of days later, 200 rounds fell on D Company. You know, the Chinese started to really stomp when we'd left. Yet while we were there, they never bothered. And I always felt the Norfolks were lucky like that. We seemed to go somewhere and it quietened down. And the moment we left, somebody else would cop it. You know, and when we went after the winter, we went in reserve for a short time. But then the exigencies of the war called us to go back into the line quicker. I think we was only out for a few days and we had to go back in the line again, back to the area where we'd been before, up near Bunker Hill on 355 there. And as I say, the position we'd vacated starts to get clobbered when we leave. And we go to another place. We took over from the Americans. It was the, I think they were called 15th Infantry Regiment. The name they had was Can-Dos. And we took over from them. And they were saying, oh, this place is well looked over, overlooked by the enemy. Don't get on the skyline. Keep to the communication trenches. They even had cardboard notices up. You know, keep your head down from here on, you're under observation from here. Things like that. And they said it was a pretty hairy place to be. And other than, again, spasmodic mortaring and the occasional shell, nothing. You know, we had it quiet, quite quiet. And yet next to us, we had this short valley. Next to us were the Americans. And just ahead of them was a feature called Greece. Just ahead of that was a feature called Italy. And they were constantly having trouble there. And we'd be standing in our trenches at Stand 2 or at night on Stag, and flashes and bangs coming from that side, nothing to us. It was strange. You know, early in the year, is something I should have said before, the platoon I was with, two platoon, that was under Pullen, Lieutenant Pullen at the time, later Captain Pullen, he was in charge of the independent platoon, which I was a member of, and we'd gone up to a feature, a hill, we called it the Pimple, forward of 355, which was on, we were there at November the 4th, when the big assault came on, you know, where Speakman won his VC, where the big assault came on the Cosby positions, and the shelling was coming all over onto us as well, and we were up there, on that hill, watching the Chinese assault 217 and 317, which they took, and didn't attack us at all. Okay, it seems strange that, you know, they seem to go all round and we seem to live a charmed life. As I say, our casualties, I thought, overall were very low for the time we were there. We seem to live a charmed life, as I said. But one of the things that did happen in 51 on November the 4th, 5th, after that, the Americans' Air Force were the Shooting Star aeroplanes, Lockheeds they were, Shooting Stars. I think they're F something, some number. Anyway, they were constantly there and attacking the enemy, and they were attacking 217, which is now occupied by the Chinese, and 317. And as they were attacking them, one of these Shooting Stars, it overshot, made a mistake, and napalmed us. Two napalm bombs came out. Didn't do any damage, hit the top of the hill, run along the top of the hill. But our platoon sergeant, Nobby Clark, he dived into his bunker, overturned a brew up that he was having and burnt all his legs and ended up in, or burnt all his legs, he only got two legs, burnt his legs and had to go back for hospital treatment. That was the only casualty we suffered. But there were